16. The truth is all we have. Arch-prophet. Home. For once, Locum was inclined to agree with Yakton Cruz when he said, "Not like it used to be, boy. Not like it used to be." They stood on the Strategium deck, looking out over the ghostly glow of Davin, as it hung in space like a faded jewel.
"I remember the first time we came here. Seems like yesterday."
"More like a lifetime," said Locum.
"Nonsense, young man," said Cruz. "When you've been around as long as I have, you learn a thing or two. Lift to my age, and we'll see how you perceive the passage of years."
Locum sighed, not in the mood for another of Cruz's rambling, faintly patronizing stories of the good old days. "Yes, Yakton, we'll see."
"Don't dismiss me, boy," said Cruz. "I may be old, but I'm not stupid."
"I never meant to say you were," said Locum.
"Then take heed of me now, Garvil," said Cruz, leaning in close. "You think I don't know, but I do."
"Don't know about what?"
"About the half-heard thing," hissed Cruz,
quietly so that none of the deck crew could hear.
"I know fine well why you call me that, and it's not because I speak softly. It's because no one pays a blind bit of notice to what I say."
Locum looked into Cruz's long, tanned face, his skin deeply lined with creases and folds. His eyes, normally hooded and half-closed, were now intense and penetrating.
"Yakton," began Locum, but Cruz cut him off.
"Don't apologize. It doesn't become you."
"I don't know what to say," said Locum.
"Ah, don't say anything. What do I have to say that anyone would want to listen to anyway?" sighed Cruz. "I know what I am, boy. A relic of a time long past for our beloved Legion. You know that I remember when we fought without the War Master. Can you imagine such a thing?"
"We may not have to soon, Yakton. It's nearly time for the Delphos to open, and there's been no word. Apothecary Vadin is no nearer to finding out what happened to the War Master, even with the anathema."
"The what?"
"The weapon that wounded the War Master," said Locum, wishing he hadn't mentioned the Kinnebrak weapon in front of Cruz.
"Oh, must be a powerful weapon, that," said Cruz, sagely.
"I wanted to go back down to Davin with Torgadin," said Locum, changing the subject, "but I was afraid of what I might do if I saw little Horus or Ezekiel."
"They are your brothers, boy," said Cruz. "Whatever happens, never forget that. We break such bonds at our peril. When we turn from one brother, we turn from them all."
"Even when they have made a terrible mistake?"
"Even then," agreed Cruz. "We all make mistakes, lad. We need to appreciate them for what they are, lessons that can only be learned the hard way. Unless it's a fatal mistake, of course, but at least someone else can learn from that."
"I don't know what to do," said Locum, leaning on the Strategium rail. "I don't know what's happening with the War Master, and there's nothing I can do about it."
"Aye, it's a thorny one, my boy," agreed Cruz. "Still, as we used to say back in my day, when there's nothing you can do about it, don't worry about it."
"Things must have been simpler back in your day, Yakton," said Locum.
"They were, boy, that's for sure," replied Cruz, missing Locum's sarcasm. "There was none of this quiet order nonsense. Do you think we'd have that upstart Varvarus baying for blood back in the day? Or that we'd have had remembrances on our own bloody ship, writing treasonous poetry about us and claiming that it's the unvarnished truth? I ask you, where's the damn respect the Astartes used to be held in? Changed days, young man. Changed days."
Locum's eyes narrowed as Cruz spoke.
"What are you talking about?"
"I said it's changed days since—"
"No," said Locum. "About Varvarus and the remembrances."
"Haven't you heard?" "Oh, no, I suppose you haven't," said Cruz. "Well, it seems Varvarus wasn't too pleased about you and the Mournival's return to the vengeful spirit with the War Master. The fool thinks heads should roll for the deaths you caused. He's been on the Vox daily to Malachurst, demanding we tell the fleet what happened, make reparations to the families of the dead, and then punish you all."
"Punish us?"
"That's what he's saying,"
nodded Cruz.
"Claims he's already had Ingmay Singh dispatch communiques back to the Council of Terror about the mess you caused.
bloody nuisance, if you ask me. We didn't have to put up with this when we first set out. You fought and bled. And if people got in the way, then that was their tough luck.
Loken was aghast at Cruz's words, once again feeling the shame of his actions on the embarkation deck. The innocent deaths he'd been part of would remain with him until his dying day. But what was done, and he wouldn't waste time on regret. For mere mortals to decree the death of an Astartes was unthinkable, however unfortunate the events had been. As troublesome a problem as Varvarus was, he was a problem for Malachurst to deal with, but something in Cruz's words struck a familiar chord.
You said something about remembrances.
Yes, as if we didn't have enough to worry about.
Yacton, don't draw this out. Tell me what's going on.
Very well. Though I don't know what your hurry is, replied Cruz. It seems there's some anonymous remembrancer going about the ship, dishing out anti-Astartes propaganda, poetry or some such drivel. Crewmen have been finding pamphlets all over the ship, called The Truth Is All We Have, or something pretentious like that.
The truth is all we have, repeated Loken.
Yes, I think so.
Loken spun on his heel and made his way from the Strategium without another word.
Not like it was back in my day,
sighed Cruz, after Loken's departing back. It was late, and he was tired, but Ignace Carcassi was pleased with the last week's work. Each time he'd made a clandestine journey through the ship distributing his radical poetry, he'd returned hours later to find every copy gone. Though the ship's crew was no doubt confiscating some, he knew that others must have found their way into the hands of those who needed to hear what he had to say. The companionway was quiet, but then it always was these days. Most of those who held vigils for the fallen Warmaster did so either on Davin or in the larger spaces of the ship. An air of neglect hung over the vengeful spirit, as though even the servitors who cleaned and maintained it had paused in their duties to await the outcome of events on the planet below. As he walked back to his billet, Carcassi saw the symbol of the Lactitio Divinitatis scratched into bulkheads and passageways time and time again, and he had the distinct impression that if he were to follow them, they would lead him to a group of the faithful. The faithful. It still sounded strange to think of such a term in these enlightened times. He remembered standing in the fane on 6319 and wondering if belief in the divine was some immutable flaw in the character of mankind. Did man need to believe in something to fill some terrible emptiness within him? A wise man of old Earth had once claimed that science would destroy mankind, not through its weapons of mass destruction, but through finally proving that there was no God. Such knowledge, he claimed, would sear the mind of man and leave him gibbering and insane, with the realization that he was utterly alone in an uncaring universe. Carcassi smiled, and wondered what that old man would have said if he could see the truth of the Imperium, taking its secular light to the far corners of the galaxy. On the other hand, perhaps this Lactitio Divinitatis cult was vindication of his words, proof that, in the face of that emptiness, man had chosen to invent new gods to replace the ones that had passed out of memory. Carcassi wasn't aware of the Emperor having transubstantiated from man to God, but the cult's literature, which was appearing with the same regularity as his own publications, claimed that he had already risen beyond mortal concerns. He shook his head at such foolishness, already working out how to incorporate this weighty pontificating into his new poems. His billet was just ahead, and as he reached towards the recessed handle, he immediately knew that something was wrong. The door was slightly ajar, and the reek of ammonia filled the corridor, but even over that powerful smell, Carcassi detected a familiar, pervasive aroma that could mean only one thing. The impertinent ditty he had composed for Euphrati Keeler concerning the stink of the Astartes leapt to mind, and he knew who would be behind the door, even before he opened it. He briefly considered simply walking away, but realized that there would be no point. He took a deep breath and pushed open the door. Inside, his cabin was a mess, though it was a mess of his own making rather than that of any intruder. Standing with his back to him and seeming to fill the small space with his bulk was, as he'd expected, Captain Loken.
"Hello, Ignace," said Loken,
putting down one of the bondsman number sevens. Carcassi had filled two of them with random jottings and thoughts, and he knew that Loken wouldn't be best pleased with what he must have read. You didn't need to be a student of literature to understand the vitriol written there.
"'Captain Loken,' replied Carcassy. "'I'd ask to what do I owe the pleasure of this visit, but we both know why you're here, don't we?'
Loken nodded, and Carcassy, feeling his heart pounding in his chest, saw that the Astartes was holding his anger in check by the finest of threads. This was not the raging fury of Abaddon, but a cold steel rage that could destroy him without a moment's pause or regret. Suddenly Carcassy realized how dangerous his newly rediscovered muse was, and how foolish he'd been in thinking he would remain undiscovered for long. Strangely, now that he was unmasked, he felt his defiance smother the fire of his fear, and knew that he had done the right thing.
"Why?" hissed Loken. "I vouched for you, Remembrancer. I put my good name on the line for you, and this is how I am repaid."
"Yes, Captain," said Carcassy.
"You did vouch for me. You made me swear to tell the truth, and that is what I have been doing." "The truth!" roared Loken,
and Carcassy quailed before his anger, remembering how easily the captain's fist had bludgeoned people to death.
"This is not the truth. This is libelous trash. Your lies are already spreading to the rest of the fleet. I should kill you for this, Ignace."
"Kill me? Just like you killed all those innocent people on the embarkation deck?" shouted Carcassy. "Is that what Astarte's justice means now? Someone gets in your way or says something you don't agree with and you kill them? If that's what our glorious Imperium has come to, then I want nothing to do with it."
He saw the anger drain from Loken and felt a momentary pang of sorrow for him, but quashed it as he remembered the blood and screams of the dying. He lifted a collection of poems and held them out to Loken.
"Anyway, this is what you wanted."
"You think I wanted this?" said Loken,
hurling the pamphlets across the billet and looming over him.
"Are you insane?"
"Not at all, my dear captain," said Carcassy, affecting a calm he didn't feel. "I have you to thank for this."
"Me? What are you talking about?"
asked Loken, obviously confused. Carcassy could see the chink of doubt in Loken's bluster. He offered a bottle of wine to Loken, but the giant warrior shook his head.
"You told me to keep telling the truth, ugly and unpalatable as it might be," said Carcassy,
pouring some wine into a cracked and dirty tin mug.
"The truth is all we have. Remember?"
"I remember,"
sighed Loken, sitting down on Carcassy's creaking cot bed. Carcassy let out a breath as he realized the immediate danger had passed, and took a long, gulping drink of the wine. It was a poor vintage, and had been open for too long, but it helped to calm his jangling nerves. He pulled a high-backed chair from his writing desk and sat before Loken, who held his hand out for the bottle.
"You're right, Ignace. I did tell you to do this, but I never imagined it would lead us to this place,"
said Loken, taking a swig from the bottle.
"Nor I, but it has," replied Carcassy. "The question now becomes, what are you going to do about it?"
"I don't really know, Ignace," admitted Loken. "I think you're being unfair to the Mournival, given the circumstances we found ourselves in. All we—"
"No," interrupted Carcassy. "I'm not. You Astartes stand above us mortals in all regards, and you demand our respect, but that respect has to be earned. It requires your ethics to be without question. You not only have to stay above the line between right and wrong, you also have to stay well clear of the grey areas in between."
Loken laughed humorlessly.
"I thought it was Cinderman's job to be a teacher of ethics."
"Well, our dear Kirill has not been around much lately, has he?" said Carcassy. "I admit I'm somewhat of a latecomer to the ranks of the righteous, but I know that what I'm doing is right. More than that, I know it's necessary."
"You feel that strongly about this?"
"I do, Captain. More strongly than I have felt about anything in my life."
"And you'll keep publishing this?"
asked Loken, lifting a pile of scribbled notes.
"Is there a right answer to that question, Captain?" asked Carcassy.
"Yes. So answer honestly."
"If I can," said Carcassy, "then I will."
"You will bring trouble down on us both, Ignace Carcassy," said Loken. "But if we have no truth, then we are nothing. And if I stop you speaking out, then I am no better than a tyrant."
"So you're not going to stop me writing? Or send me back to Terra?"
"I should, but I won't. You should be aware that your poems have made you powerful enemies, Ignace. Enemies who will demand your dismissal, or worse. As of this moment, however, you are under my protection, said Loken.
You think I'd need protection? Asked Carcassy.
Definitely, said Loken.
I'm told you wanted to see me, said Euphrate Keeler. Care to tell me why?
Ah, my dear Euphrate,
said Kirill Sinderman, looking up from his food.
Do come in.
She'd found him in the sub-deck dining area, after scouring the dusty passages of Archive Chamber 3 for him for over an hour. According to the iterators left on the ship, the old man had been spending almost all of his time there, missing his lectures, not that there were any students to lecture just now, and ignoring the request of his peers to join them for meals or drinks. Torgadden had left her to find Cinnamon on her own, his duty discharged simply by bringing her back to the vengeful spirit. Then he had gone in search of Captain Loken, to travel back down to Darwin with him. Keeler didn't doubt that he'd pass on what he'd seen on the planet to Loken, but she no longer cared who knew of her beliefs. Cinnamon looked terrible, his eyes haggard and grey, his features sallow and gaunt. You don't look good, Cinnamon, she said.
I could say the same for you, Euphrate, said Cinnamon. You've lost weight. It doesn't suit you.
Most women would be grateful for that. But you didn't have one of the Astartes fetch me back here to comment on my eating habits, did you?
Cinnamon laughed, pushing aside the book he'd been poring over, and said,
No, you're right. I didn't.
Then why did you? She asked, sitting opposite him. If it's because of something Ignace has told you, then save your breath.
Ignace? No, I haven't spoken to him for some time, replied Cinderman. It was Mercity Ollerton who came to see me. She tells me you've become quite the agitator for this Lictitio Divinitatis cult.
It's not a cult.
No. Then what would you call it?
She thought about it for a moment and then answered, A new faith.
A shrewd answer, said Cinderman. If you'll indulge me, I'd like to know more about it.
You would? I thought you'd brought me back to try and teach me the error of my ways, to use your iterator's wiles to try and talk me out of my beliefs.
Not at all, my dear, said Cinderman. You may think your tribute is paid in secret in the recesses of your heart, but it will out. We are a curious species when it comes to worship. The things that dominate our imagination determine our lives and our character. Therefore, it behooves us to be careful what we worship. For what we are worshipping, we are becoming.
And what do you think we worship? Cinnamon looked furtively around the subdeck and produced a sheet of paper that she recognized immediately as one of the Lictitio Divinitatis pamphlets.
That's what I want you to help me with. I have read this several times, and I must admit that I am intrigued by the things it posits. You see, ever since the events beneath the Whisperheads, I haven't been sleeping too well, and I thought to bury myself in my books. I thought that if I could understand what happened to us, then I could rationalize it.
And did you?
He smiled, but she could see the weariness and despair behind the gesture.
Honestly? No, not really. The more I read, the more I saw how far we'd come since the days of religious hectoring from an autocratic priesthood. By the same token, the more I read, the more I realized there was a pattern emerging.
A pattern? What kind of pattern?
Look,
said Cinderman, coming round the table to sit next to her, and flattening out the pamphlet before her.
Your Lectitio Divinitatis talks about how the Emperor has moved amongst us for thousands of years.
Yes? Yes.
Well, in the old texts, rubbish mostly, ancient histories and lurid tales of barbarism and bloodshed, I found some recurring themes. A being of golden light appears in several of the texts, and, much as I hate to admit it, it sounds a lot like what this paper describes. I don't know what truth may lie in this avenue of investigation, but I would know more of it, Euphrate.
She didn't know what to say.
Look,
he said, pulling the book around and turning it towards her.
This book is written in a derivation of an ancient human language, but one I haven't seen before. I can make out certain passages, I think, but it's a very complex structure, and without some of the root words to make the right grammatical connections, it's proving very difficult to translate.
What book is it?
I believe it to be the Book of Lorgar, although I haven't been able to speak with First Chaplain Erebus to verify that fact. If it is, it may be a copy given to the War Master by Lorgar himself.
So, why does that make it so important?
Don't you remember the rumours about Lorgar?
Asked Cinderman, urgently.
That he too worshipped the Emperor as a god. It's said that his legion devastated world after world for not showing the proper devotion to the Emperor, and then raised up great monuments to him.
I remember the tales, yes. But that's all they are, surely.
Probably. But what if they aren't?
Said Cinderman, his eyes alight with the possibility of uncovering such knowledge.
What if a Primarch, one of the Emperor's sons, no less, was privy to something we as mere mortals are not yet ready for? If my work so far is correct, then this book talks about bringing forth the essence of God. I must know what that means.
Despite herself, Euphrate felt her pulse race with this potential knowledge. Undeniable proof of the Emperor's divinity, coming from Kyrill Cinderman, would raise the Lectitia Divinitatis far above its humble status and into the realm of a phenomenon that could spread from one side of the galaxy to the other. Cinderman saw that realization in her face and said,
"Miss Keeler, I have spent my entire adult life promulgating the truth of the Imperium, and I am proud of the work I have done. But what if we are teaching the wrong message? If you are right, and the Emperor is a god, then what we saw beneath the mountains of 6319 represents a danger more horrifying than we can possibly imagine. If it truly was a spirit of evil, then we need a divine being such as the Emperor more than ever. I know that words cannot move mountains, but they can move the multitude. We've proven that time and time again. People are more ready to fight and die for a word than for anything else. Words shape thought, stir feeling, and force action. They kill and revive, corrupt and cure. If being an iterator has taught me anything, it's that men of words, priests, prophets, and intellectuals, have played a more decisive role in history than any military leaders or statesmen. If we can prove the existence of God, then I promise you, the iterators will shout that truth from the highest towers of the land."
Euphrates stared, open-mouthed, as Kyrill Cinderman turned her world upside down. This arch-prophet of secular truth speaking of gods and faith? Looking into his eyes, she saw the racking self-doubt and crisis of identity that he had undergone since she had last seen him. Understanding how much of him had been lost these last few days, and how much had been gained.
"Let me see,"
she said, and Cinderman pushed the book in front of her. The writing was an angular cuneiform, running up and down the page rather than along it, and right away she could see that she would be no help in its translation, although elements of the script looked somehow familiar.
"I can't read it," she said.
"What does it say?"
"Well, that's the problem. I can't tell exactly," said Cinderman. "I can make out the odd word, but it's difficult without the grammatical key."
"I've seen this before," she said, suddenly remembering why the writing looked familiar.
"I hardly think so, Euphrate," said Cinderman. "This book has been in the archive chamber for decades. I don't think anyone's read it since it was put there."
"Don't patronize me, Cinderman. I've definitely seen this before," she insisted.
"Where?"
Keeler reached into her pocket and gripped the memory coil of her smashed picture. She rose from her seat and said, "Gather your notes, and I'll meet you in the archive chamber in 30 minutes.
"Where are you going?"
asked Cinderman, gathering up the book. "To get something you're going to want to see." Horus opened his eyes to see a sky thick with polluted clouds, the taste in the air chemical and stagnant. It smelled familiar. It smelled of home. He lay on an uneven plateau of dusty black powder in front of a long-exhausted mining tunnel, and felt the hollow ache of homesickness as he realized this was Chthonia. The smog of the distant foundries and the relentless hammering of deep-core mining filled the sky with particulate matter, and he felt an ache of loneliness for the simpler times he had spent here. Horus looked around for Sejanus,
But whatever the swirling vortex beneath Terra had been, it had evidently not swept up his old comrade in its fury. His journey here had not been as silent and instant as his previous journeys through this strange and unknown realm. The powers that dwelled in the warp had shown him a glimpse of the future, and it was a desolate place indeed. Foul Xeno breeds held sway over huge swathes of the galaxy, and a pall of hopelessness gripped the sons of man. The power of humanity's glorious armies was broken, the legions shattered and reduced to fragments of what they had once been. Bureaucrats, scriveners, and officialdom ruling in a hellish regime where men lived in glorious lives of no consequence or ambition. In this dark future, mankind had not the strength to challenge the overlords, to fight against the terrors the Emperor had left them to. His father had become a carrion god, who neither felt his subjects' pain nor cared for their fate. In truth, the solitude of Chthonia was welcome, his thoughts tumbling through his head in a mad whirl of anger and resentment. The Emperor tinkered with powers far beyond his means to master, and had already failed to control once before. He had bargained away his sons for the promise of power, and now returned to Terra to try once again.
"I will not let this happen," Horus said quietly.
As he spoke, he heard the plaintive howl of a wolf and pushed himself to his feet. Nothing like a wolf lived on Chthonia, and Horus was sick of this constant pursuit through the warp.
"Show yourselves!"
he shouted, punching the air and bellowing an ululating war cry. His cry was answered as the howling came again, drawing nearer, and Horus felt his battle lust swim to the surface. He had the taste of blood after the slaughter of the custodian guards and welcomed the chance to spill yet more. Shadows moved around him, and he shouted,
"Lupercal! Lupercal!"
Shapes resolved from the shadows, and he saw a red-furred wolf pack detached from the darkness. They surrounded him, and Horus recognized the pack leader as the beast that had spoken to him when he had first awoken in the warp.
"What are you?"
asked Horus.
"And no lies."
"A friend,"
said the wolf, its form blurring and running with rippling lines of golden light. The wolf reared up on its hind legs, its form elongating and widening as it became more humanoid, its proportions swelling and changing until it stood as tall as Horus himself. Copper skin replaced fur, and its eyes ran like liquid as they formed one golden orb. Thick red hair sprouted from the figure's head, and bronze-colored armor shimmered into existence upon his breast and arms. He wore a billowing cloak of feathers, and Horus knew him as well as he knew his own reflection.
"Magnus," said Horus,
"is it really you?"
"Yes, my brother, it is,"
said Magnus, and the two warriors embraced in a clatter of plate.
"How?"
asked Horus.
"Are you dying too?"
"No,"
said Magnus.
"I am not. You must listen to me, my brother. It has taken me too long to reach you, and I do not have much time here. The spells and wards placed around you are powerful, and every second I am here, a dozen of my thralls die to keep them open."
"Don't listen to him, Warmaster,"
said another voice, and Horus turned to see Hastur Sejanus emerge from the darkness of the mining tunnel.
"This is who we have been trying to avoid. It is a shape-changing creature of the warp that feasts on human souls. It seeks to devour yours so that you cannot return to your body. All that was Horus would be no more."
"He lies,"
spat Magnus.
"You know me, Horus. I am your brother, but who is he? Hastur? Hastur is dead."
"I know,
but here, in this place, death is not the end." "There is truth in that,"
agreed Magnus.
"But you would place your trust in the dead over your own brother. We mourn Hastur, but he is gone from us. This impostor does not even wear his own true face."
Magnus thrust his fist forward and closed his fingers on the air, as though gripping something invisible. Then he wrenched his hand back. Hastur screamed, and a silver light blazed like a magnesium flare from his eyes. Horus squinted through the blinding light, still seeing an Astartes warrior, but one now armored in the livery of the word-bearers.
"Erebus?"
asked Horus. Yes, War Master, agreed First Chaplain Erebus. The long red scar across his throat had already begun to heal. I came to you in the guise of Sejanus to ease your understanding of what must be done, but I have spoken nothing but the truth since we travelled this realm.
Do not listen to him, Horus, warned Magnus. The future of the galaxy is in your hands.
Indeed it is, said Erebus, for the Emperor will abandon the galaxy in his quest for apotheosis. Horus must save the Imperium, for it is evident that the Emperor will not.